2FM with Green Fern. Naturally good food packed with protein.
Thanks to Jenny Green, it's Tuesday the 22nd of September and this is Game On.
Coming up today, it's that man Sam Bennett. He's with us to talk about winning and much, much more.
One Sunday morning, we're having dinner at my parents' house and Carrick Wheelers were obviously holding one of the races, and next thing, a load of, you know, young cyclists around Sam's age passed by on bikes and everything in the gear, and he jumped up from the dinner table and he said, that's what I want to do.
Mark Langdon has lots of European transfer news, plus his thoughts on Gareth Bale's return.
It's great to be back here at the club where I made my name and start and made great memories. So yeah, looking forward now to create new ones and hopefully create history at this club again.
Tomorrow is Kerry National Day and last year's winning jockey, Rachel Blackmore, looks to head to tomorrow's renewal.
The final two fences in the Guinness Kerry National Poker Party. Shantou Village, a mistake. Here's Ravenhill on the near side. Shantou Village has lost rugby power. Poker Party and Ravenhill to the judge. Poker Party on the far side of Ravenhill in a crackerjack Guinness Kerry National finish.
Plus, we've Gary Murphy on a huge week for Irish golf, and we're live to the BBC as plans for fans at English Sport are shelved until next March.
Game on 2FM.
You can get in touch by texting us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. Now, earlier today, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson confirmed plans for fans to return to watch live sport events in England from the 1st of October will not go ahead. The plans were placed under review after a rise in coronavirus cases. The Prime Minister also said that current restrictions are likely to remain in place for the next 6 months. So to talk us through what that means for sport, we are joined by Sarah Mulcairns, broadcaster with the BBC. Sarah, was this decision to curb the return of fans expected?
I think over the last week, there were some feelings that this may well happen, I think. There has been, I suppose, a shift in people's awareness and attitude over the last couple of weeks in the UK regarding the rise in cases and how that might potentially affect everybody's lives, be it, you know, going to work, going out, socialising, and of course sport comes into that. We did know that there were these piloting events going on across a different range of sports. So we had football league games, we had racing, we had rugby, all piloting different ways of coping with bringing in a small percentage of fans. But I think that over the last kind of 24, 48 hours, things escalated a little bit more than we had perhaps anticipated. But I'm not sure a lot of the sporting clubs and governing bodies expected the announcement this morning that came, because even if you look at the rugby match today between Bath and Gloucester, that's one of the pilot events which was due to have 1,000 fans in tonight. And even after the announcement came from Michael Gove on BBC Breakfast this morning and then from Boris Johnson in the House of Commons, even after that announcement, Bath and Gloucester were saying, well, this is from the 1st of October, we're still going to bring fans in. And then suddenly a couple of hours later, they talked to the DCMS, which is basically the Digital Culture Media Committee, who liaise with a lot of these governing bodies between themselves and the government. They had a chat with them mid-morning, and suddenly we get the news that actually the fans are off this evening. So I think it did catch sporting bodies and organisers by surprise, I suppose, how quickly it escalated.
Sarah, has there been any data or proof or information to suggest that those pilot events were adding to the spread of coronavirus or anything along those lines?
Well, the sporting governing bodies are saying that there hasn't been anything like that. A lot of people are pointing to the fact that if you have people socially distanced and outdoors, that is one of the better places. I know today, I mean, you know, on social media, you know, you don't want to go down the rabbit holes there sometimes. But people are genuinely asking the question, if a certain amount of people can go to see a football match or go to the races or go to a rugby match and they're sitting far enough apart and they're outside, how is that different or how is that worse than them going into a pub and sitting indoors with other people watching it in a smaller place? And the governing bodies, sporting governing bodies, are saying that they don't have any data, you know, yet that kind of says that this is adding to it. I think where this a lot of this seems to be coming from is in terms of the UK initially when it went into lockdown and the perception and the criticism that the government got then around certain events that didn't shut down quick enough. So you think back to the Liverpool game in the Champions League against Atletico Madrid, and you think back to Cheltenham as well. And while people were being asked to work from home and isolate, that certain things went ahead. And I think there's an awareness that there is a council investigation into that Liverpool game and why that went ahead. And there's been calls for an investigation against Cheltenham. So I think there's a little bit of scar tissue there, and perhaps trying to proceed with more caution than they did before. However, you know, people are wondering why you can do some things and not do others. But I suppose that's the nature of, you know, all sorts of restrictions that we're having to make at the moment. But, you know, the one thing that in these pilots, you're getting the temperature checks, you're getting track and trace, you know, they're doing everything they say within their limits to make sure it is safe for everybody that is attending, and lots of people are saying, you know, that those measures aren't in place in other facets of life, so why can't they carry on with this?
Very similar discussions and debates have been held over here as well, and the justification and explanation for it seems to be that it's the congregation after these big events that is causing the issue, not what happens inside in the stadiums or on the racetrack or wherever the crowds were being piloted and trialled. Sarah, 6 months though, that I think seems to be the thing that is really surprising and worrying people, just purely from a financial point of view. And, you know, we think about Premier League games with huge crowds or Six Nations, but a lot of the time it's the lower leagues and the smaller teams and clubs are the ones that are ultimately going to really suffer.
Yeah, absolutely. And you just look at some of the figures that, you know, a lot of these governing bodies are talking about today. You know, the Premier League, even with the might of the broadcasting deals that has, you know, they are thinking that it's going to be up to £700 million that they will lose over the course of the next season if they don't have fans in stadiums. And then you go down to the Football League, which is in, you know, a lot of those clubs are in such a bigger, you know, more precarious situation. They've lost 50 million already since March, and they would be looking at a loss of 200 million for the upcoming season. You look at rugby in England, they were banking on the fact that they would be able to get fans into Twickenham for these rescheduled events later this year. They're going to lose 50 million. They're having to make redundancies to their staff. The ECB, the England and Wales Cricket Board, they're having to make redundancies. We've seen a Football League club, Macclesfield Town, who, in fairness, they had been in financial difficulties anyway pre-coronavirus, but that impacted it. And that club no longer exists after being wound up in the High Court last week. And there's been an awful lot of warnings, you know, from chairmen of football clubs and chairwomen of football clubs around the fact that if there is not some sort of financial support coming from the government, that if they're not going to allow fans in for at least the next 6 months, that there has to be, you know, support put in place. We've seen in the UK over the summer, there was a 1.5 billion bailout for the arts industry, and we know that right now the culture secretary is meeting with an awful lot of the representatives for various sporting bodies, and this is something that they're going to be thrashing out. And we do think that there's perhaps going to be some sort of financial support coming out to help, you know, smaller clubs survive, but also to keep interest at grassroots level, because a lot of the stuff, when you're making cutbacks and the cutbacks that are being made, a lot of it is at grassroots level. So they're really worried about the next generation of athletes, of, you know, coaches, of fans coming through, that they will all be lost if there's not some sort of support underneath this, if there is not going to be this you know, financial impact, you know, for fans coming through the gates over the next 6 months.
Sarah, has there been any talk or speculation of some sports simply saying, we can't afford this, and pulling up for 6 months, stopping completely?
Well, if you look below, you have the Premier League and then the Football League, and then you go into non-league football, and they were due to restart their season, and they're now going to postpone that, we believe, until January. So they're not even, you know, going to restart their season. And a lot of that is to do with how the furlough scheme worked here in the UK, in that you could be given some support, but then if you go back working, they're having to, you know, essentially fork out money again for all these players. It costs putting a game on if you're having nobody coming through at that real low level. Can they afford to do it? The costs outweigh it. And so in terms of the National League trying to support its clubs and its players as best they can, they say there is just no way they can do that without fans. So they're looking at just postponing it until January at the moment. But who knows in terms of whether that can then go ahead in January. And I think that's going to be a big question for the leagues and the clubs and the sports at the moment that don't have big broadcasting deals or don't have, you know, lottery funding for sporting or grants from Sport England and that to try and help them. I think there's going to be real severe kind of questions about whether they can continue to exist.
The leaders of more than 100 sporting bodies have written to the Prime Minister to ask for emergency funding, warning of a lost generation of activity because of the coronavirus. So, you know, that's a worry too, not even just the elite, it's the participation.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you think that, you know, at the moment you can still do stuff outdoors, but a lot of stuff over the winter will happen indoors. And, you know, that is one of the biggest concerns over the next 6 months, is how do you get people, you know, still involved in sport and participating in some of the coaching or organised sporting activities that can still run if they're indoors? Because there's some speculation at the moment that that won't be allowed to go ahead. And if you come into it, you know, from essentially you get to next March, you have, you know, athletes, you have young kids who are out of it for a whole year. You know, what does that do to everybody? And I suppose, you know, in terms of your psychology and your mentality, you know, if you're parents and you're putting your kids into that situation and you have people that you're caring for, it's all these wider decisions that families and individuals are having to make. And then you have sporting governing bodies trying to facilitate that and encourage people getting into sport and keeping active. And we know how important it is for your fitness and for your mental health. And, you know, we all understand the dilemmas that this pandemic is posing, and that there are not the answers that everybody wants no matter how much you want it.
We're obviously keeping a very close eye on Northern Ireland as well. And just now, the Stormont executive has announced that they're not going to make any immediate moves after the halting of the planned return of fans to English sporting venues. Would you have any insight into maybe what they could potentially do?
I think there will be severe lobbying going on behind the scenes. I know that there's, you know, talks around because even if you look at like season ticket holders and what they will have, you know, because they've essentially, you know, a lot of season ticket holders have paid out for their tickets for the coming months. And there may be kind of special access, special, you know, kind of streams that they can go to view on. But I think beyond sporting governing bodies talking to the government and trying to run trials and proving that there's not any significant impact of fans attending and that they can do it safely, you know, they are up against the fact that the government is dealing with a wider pandemic which is affecting across society. So I think, you know, sporting governing bodies will be trying to do all that they can to make sure that they can continue in as safe a way as possible. But ultimately, they know that they can't control the pandemic.
Sarah Mulcairns, thanks a million. Here's hoping that the word perhaps that Boris Johnson mentioned actually comes in. Perhaps it'll only be 6 months. Thank you.
With Green Fern, naturally good food packed with protein. Game on 2FM.
I think, yeah, no fear is a thing, because when you see the sprinters, you know, the risk they take going around those corners, the physical pushing about, fighting for wheels, and, you know, the pushing and elbow going on there, it's amazing. It's amazing those guys can stay upright, but, you know, they are the kamikaze guys, and you have to be a bit crazy to be a sprinter.
Now, that was the voice of Sean Kelly there speaking about sprinters. And I think we're all talking about cycling and the Tour de France after Sam Bennett's exploits over the last 3 weeks. And the dust is just beginning to settle and all of that. I'm not sure if the celebrations have finished yet, though. We will soon find out as Sam joins us now on the line. Sam, has it all sunk in yet?
I'm not sure yet. I'm still on the go, but still on a high. So, I don't think I've sunk in yet, no.
Has it calmed down a little bit, though? It seemed a bit crazy there for a while in the aftermath.
Yeah, it hasn't really calmed down yet. I've been busy since traveling back and everything. And then I still had a lot of anti-doping calling to the house after the race. So I've been kept busy the last few hours.
We just heard Sean Kelly there speaking about sprinters. He said you have to be a bit mad to be one. What do you think?
I think we all have a screw loose. we're going pretty fast at times, and we only have a bit of leg protecting us. So it's often fairly physical, and it can hurt when you hit the deck.
So I'm well aware how hurtful falls can be, but I must say watching the sprints and the different cameras and the angles fascinated me all through the Tour de France, and to watch your lead out train and Caleb Ewan sitting behind you and how the different sprints evolved throughout the 3 weeks. And as the Tour went on, did you, I can't say enjoy them, but did you look back on each one and think, well, look, we'll try this tomorrow, or did you stick to the same plan all the time?
I think, you know, you always had to approach each one different because you had different winds, like coming from the side or from the front or from the back. You had different gradients, different run-ins. But the thing about it was, because I was doing so many of the intermediate sprints, it was actually like we were getting extra practice. And being in a new team this year, it really helped to gel with the guys, and as the race went on, we got better and better at the timing and the delivery and the pacing going in, and it was all almost like, you know, we had to communicate less because we really got to know what each other, well, what each guy was thinking and what each guy needed, and it was an enjoyable few weeks.
I must say I enjoy tactics, and I watch tactics, and I look at it for every sport to see what I could have learned when I was a jockey. But to watch you on the Champs-Élysées on Sunday as you came on to the final stretch, almost pull back off the guys in front to wait for the ones coming from behind, I was looking at it thinking, wow, the confidence to sit back when you're getting so close to the end before you went. Was that from the practice through the Tour that you found that confidence, or was it just winning or the fact you were wearing the green jersey?
It's a strange one because the first goal of the day was that intermediate, and then once I had that and I had the green jersey sorted, then I could switch my mind frame, and then in the final it was just the weeks of practice, I suppose, with the lead out, and then getting the feel for it and how to deliver. And Michael always said, look, if you ever think it's too early, I always look back when I'm on the front to see where you are and to see whether I need to drop the guy off on my wheel too early, so he has to go a little bit earlier, and then it actually delivers me better, and he doesn't make it, or what the situation is. So that's 1.5k to go. There's two guys left in front of me, and I was thinking, oh God, this is way too early. But again, it was really narrow, and I didn't want to get the guys, I didn't want to have the guys to come over the top and then get stuck. So stayed with the guys, and you're still taking a little bit of wind when you're sitting in third position. Coming in, into the last corner, I felt, I could see those two track guys on my left. I knew I had the right side covered. So then when we went into the last right-hander, like from the last before, I knew there was a bit of a headwind. And then I knew Michael was going to open it up, but I also knew he was going to be aware of where I was. So I let the two track guys slot in. And then as Michael said he would, he delivered. the track lead out man a little bit too early. Then when Pedersen went, I knew that whatever side he went, I would go the opposite side and I'd have a bike length of a slipstream to run at his lead out man to accelerate into and then really go for the line.
Ruby, you're nodding along here and I can just see you and you're kind of almost braced, like you're reenacting it. Clearly you can relate.
I can relate. I would say I watched early in the tour, Sam, as Caleb Hume was stalking and I was thinking, why don't you try and lose him or drift away from him, or he's just following you. And I must say, to watch as the sprints went on and how you changed and the guys around you, to watch your lead out train, I found it fascinating. I suppose it is Sean Kelly, since I was last watching an Irish sprinter doing it, but the tactics of it, and as you say, like even judging the slipstream of a bike and a half that was going to tow you into it, I think that's all fascinating. And even to watch the GoPro bike that was on, I think one of your lead out riders, that's a brilliant shot to watch back. And you can even almost see, as Sean Kelly was explaining earlier about the elbowing and the bumping and the boring, that's a must watch for anybody.
Yeah, the camera's on Michael Morkov's bike. And they're running the whole time, so they're not on every bike, but they get some great images, and I often think that it should be something that should be live on TV so that you really get a sense of what's going on, because when you're looking at it from a helicopter shot, it just looks like a swarm of bees. It looks really smooth and easy, but there's a lot of bumping and barging and blocking and covering sides, and there's a lot going on all the time.
Sam, you mentioned a mentality shift when you got the green. What does that mean?
Well, it was kind of like when I was still chasing the green, I needed the security that I know I was going to have it, and I needed to have a certain amount of points. And I was in such a strong position, but I really needed the security of bringing it home. And then when I had it, I almost sat back and went, right, I really need to finish and I can't crash. And the last time I was in the Champs-Élysées, I was injured, but I remember in the back straight, the Champs-Élysées looks flat on TV, but it's a climb up to the roundabout, and on the back side, it's a downhill and it's fast, and we're often doing above 70 kilometres per hour when the wind is right, and it's really bumpy. And I remember that year, a guy hit a bump, lost his hands and off the bars and came down and broke his collarbone. And I was afraid of something like that happening to me, where I just didn't make it to the finish and I lost the jersey. So there was that side of really wanting to secure in the jersey. But then at the end of the day, the Champs-Élysées is like the Sprinters World Championship. It's the one that everybody wants to win. And then when I came into the last lap, there was just a switch where you just, I don't know, I can't explain it. You just, some switches and you're just on, and you just this race mode comes on and you just go for it.
I think it's called adrenaline even. But Sam, having spent a couple of years with Bora Hansgrohe riding with Peter Sagan, did that help you understand their tactics? And not so much for rivalry, but did it give you an insight into what way, how they operate and what tactics they would use and how you could devise a plan of beating them?
I think they had the upper hand because the trainers knew my capacities and my ability. So they were able to use their tactics throughout the race to try and hurt me where I'd be most vulnerable, like on the climbs and stuff. So I could see and I knew what they were always going to do. So I always had to try and cover it and cover it as best as I could and just survive and lose the least amount of points as possible until I had the upper hand again. So there was days where I had to calculate how much I could lose and then days where I knew I had to make up points. But it was a really fun battle and I quite enjoyed it.
It almost sounds mathematical. But off the back of a Grand Tour win, especially in the Tour de France, you should be riding the criteriums in the near future, but there's no criteriums this year, and I suppose that is a blow for you.
Yeah, it's mad, like, because I suppose it's a special moment in my career, and you normally get that. There's one tomorrow in France that I'm doing, but it's the only one I know of. normally in Belgium they have them for nearly a week or two afterwards. It's a weird one, but you know what? I'm just happy that I have had this opportunity to win the green jersey and win on the Champs-Élysées. So I'll take it in any way, shape, or form.
Sam, there are complexities though to being a cyclist as well, and like when you see the headlines today that two people are in police custody after an investigation was opened into suspected doping at this year's Tour de France, and then you've the Guardian saying the climate of suspicion has returned. Like, how do you react to that as a cyclist, as somebody that was being celebrated just a few hours beforehand, and you know it was all positivity to some negativity then around the race that obviously would mean so much to people?
To be honest, I haven't even read anything or looked at anything. I've just been enjoying my own moment. I'm sorry, I don't have an answer for you.
I'd say that's the best answer of all, to tell you the truth, Sam, but it always annoyed me when I opened the paper to read a headline in racing that didn't involve me, but you felt was harming your own sport or industry. But you did mention you had some anti-doping procedure yourself to fill out this week. Were you tested
whenever I won a stage, and then there's up and random drug tests, and I got morning drug tests on the rest day, I think it was, and then also I had out of hour drug tests when I returned home. I will have a few more tests, but it's more than welcome. You know, like I'm happy to do it, and it's just to prove I'm clean and that I do everything correct.
Is that frustrating that you have to prove you're clean?
I suppose it is, but I suppose I'm from a different era, and it's only in Ireland I get asked these questions, because it's just what happens to me in the media for some reason. I think because cycling isn't as big as it used to be. But it just seems to be part of it, and it's sad in a way, because it's our generation dealing with it because of another generation or an older generation or whatever it may be. But lads, it's absolutely nothing to do with me, so nothing I can do.
All you can do is keep winning and try and change the opinion that other people have of it, and I think you're doing a damn fine job of it.
Thank you very much.
It must be nice though, Sam, though, the fact that people are saying that you're changing cycling here. You know, we know through the pandemic there was a shortage of bikes, and you know, the expectation is now, and the hope is that there will be lots of kids picking up bikes and hoping to emulate you and follow in your footsteps.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, it's a fantastic sport, and it gives so many opportunities, and you get to travel to amazing places with these opportunities. And the only thing now I think Ireland is really missing is the indoor velodrome. It's something that's great for development and great for identifying talent and bringing riders through. And I think, yeah, it's the only thing now we're really missing in Ireland. And apart from that, I hope I motivate people to get out on their bikes and to really enjoy it. And but it's a beautiful sport and something that everyone should try, I think.
Well, there's plenty of space there in Abbottstown, so make sure when you meet all the politicians around Christmas time, you lobby them hard for that. But Sam, there was more Irish guys in the Tour de France. Dan Martin, we had him on before the tour started. He started off with a good injury in his back. And Nicholas Roach, he did well for a long way too.
Yeah, the guys, you know, they're fantastic athletes. Dan, the way he battled through with the injuries. And Nico, the way he's super strong and he's always there, and the work he does. And they're great, and they're great to have in the peloton with you, you know. And they're riders, you know, when I was a teenager, they were already they're pros. So it's great to be riding alongside them.
Well, Sam, we wish you all the best and the Vuelta. I'm sure that's where you're going next, and the World Championships that'll come up in the future. Thanks a million for taking our call, and I hope the party continues for a lot longer. We're going to take a break.
Game on 2FM. with Green Farm, a 100% natural range of cooked chicken, turkey and beef. Natural protein your way.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On this Tuesday evening. Marie, I do believe you have some breaking GAA news.
I do. Colm Kavanagh has just released a statement saying that he is retired from inter-county football. Thank you and goodbye. 2020 has taught us a lot. For me, it is confirmed that your health is indeed your wealth. And with that, it is time for me to step back and pass my Tyrone jersey on to the next in line. And Colm joins us now on the line. Colm, a difficult decision, I'd imagine.
Hi, a really tough one. Probably one that I've debated probably for the last few months. Went back and forward on it, but the season's starting to come back in now, and I suppose I had to make a choice. And now I felt now was the right time to do that. And it's one of those things that a good journey comes to an end.
Maybe you're shaking your head there.
Yeah, I just think you're back and forward on it. For me, retirement was something that came upon me that I couldn't wait to do. Back and forward makes me wonder, are you sure?
Yeah, look, I definitely am sure. Look, I was getting to the stage of sort of the body was breaking down, and I always said to myself, whenever my body starts responding badly and things start getting difficult, and it's the right time to do it. And I think there's a great bunch of lads there that can step in and do a better job. And that's what it's all about, getting the county to where it needs to be.
No, I don't think you were so back and forward. It seems so much clearer now when you say it that way.
Colm, 2020 is such a strange season and such a strange time right now. And if you just look at how close you've came in the last few years, and you think winter football, you think that people aren't getting the same preparation, that they might have other teams, that the gap might be narrowed at the top, and it could be a year where you have an unexpected All-Ireland winner.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. I think that if there's a year that I suppose that anyone can topple the train of Dublin, that it could be this year. Say there is the preparation side of things, the whole things have been disjointed the whole year, training methods. Look, there's a whole raft of factors that could be thrown in here that the gap could be narrowed. Yeah, there's a change of management for Dublin. There's a lot of arguments to say that this year could be someone different, but. Who knows? Only time will tell on that front.
You've had such a great career with Tyrone, and a long one as well. For you, what was the highlight?
Difficult one to say. Look, I suppose I was blessed when I came into the panel in 2007. That Tyrone were on a high, and we won All Ireland in 2008. And look, probably took it for granted at that stage of my career. I probably appreciated more the latter stages of my career, where you appreciate more that you're playing at that high level. I think when you're younger, you're a bit blasé about everything, and you expect to win every day in, day out. But Tyrone had, for many parts of my career, Tyrone didn't win very much. And coming near the end of my career, I just appreciated being able to play for the county. I wouldn't want to single out any All-Ireland wins, accolades or anything like that. It just being able to represent my county is a dream that I've always had from a kid, and as most kids do, and I've done it for a long period of time, and that in itself was brilliant to do.
Colm, as you said, you won't be looking for a jersey this year, so you can be honest now. Was Mickey Hart as tough a taskmaster as he looks?
Tougher, really tough. No, look, Mickey, I actually spoke obviously with Mickey about it, and look, I have a lot of Mickey actually had a lot of faith in me. Like, I suppose you look at my career from my early outset, I'd probably had a lot of critics very early on, and I suppose from a personal point of view, I was looking to prove them wrong, and Mickey stuck with me so on that front. So I can give him that bit of kudos. But yeah, look, Mickey knows he demands a lot of players, and as all inter-county managers do, and it's the only way to try and breed success, and that's what you have to be at.
You say critics. Did you read that criticism and really take it to heart, or was it something you just became aware of?
Not when I was young, to be honest. I was young, so I probably didn't take it to heart. Probably sort of washed over me pretty quickly. Say when you get older, I think you take things more to heart, and they resonate a lot more with you at that stage of your career. But hopefully, luckily enough, I didn't get too much of that at the latter stages. So, but now early on, so you're a young lad, you don't really look into it too much, and Twitters and social media and stuff wasn't really about back then as much. So it was grand. It was message boards and stuff like.
Colm, you evolved though as well as a player, and you know, even over the last few years, winning All-Star awards. So you really peaked towards the end of your career.
Yeah, and I say that's why probably I appreciated it more. Like I always, I suppose I was comparing nearly myself to Sean, and he won everything very early in his career and got All-Stars and got Players of the Year and whatever it was, and he was still relatively young, while I obviously didn't get anything when I was younger, and sort of the things came my way a wee bit later, you know, personally came a wee bit later in my career, and I think that you know, I hold them close. Like you don't play sports for personal awards in any stretch of the imagination, like, but look, you do appreciate things like that when they come at that stage of your career, and you've probably had a rough enough few years, and you know, people maybe saying that you shouldn't be there and stuff like that, and you don't either because you're a brother or whatnot. Like, so whenever them sort of things happened in the later stages of my career, I did appreciate it. I sat back and you know, I'd say you don't play for the awards, but you know, you have to take them at face value and, you know, appreciate that they're there.
You still play for the glory. Anyhow, I know the whole ethos of the GAA is to give back, and maybe you do coach at underage levels already, but do you have any aspiration or ideas to coach or manage at more senior levels?
I actually do. I hope one day that I do get in that. To date, I probably haven't really got involved too much in coaching, just with time constraints and that, but yeah, I think it's something that I will want to get into and start going through the ranks and seeing whether I can make a go of it. You know, staying in that GAA circle and staying in that circle will be nice, and hopefully I'll take it and hopefully team up with someone that can help me along the way.
I was looking at pictures of you a little bit earlier, and that one of yourself and your daughter Chloe in Croke Park, I think it is, and the crowds around you. It's actually just so strange seeing that and knowing that there isn't going to be those moments, you know, for you, not as a player, but even the crowds as well.
Yeah, look, and to be honest, my wife nearly, she had a go at me nearly for not for retiring as such, but we've obviously a wee man now who's won Jamie, and she was sort of going, you know, you could have played on jokingly for to hopefully get a picture in Croke Park with him, and I was like, look, the whole COVID piece would probably not happen anyway, that side of things, but yeah, look, it's nice to have them memories, and, you know, I am probably very sentimental in that regard, you know, I will look back and, you know, I think the All-Ireland final defeat to Dublin and stuff, and having pictures with Chloe on the pitch, and we obviously won the All-Ireland with the club as well, and having that, like, it's nice to have them moments that you can look back on, you know, when I'm older, and I think we'll appreciate them.
And looking ahead now to the season, you might as well get your pundit hat on, because we will be no doubt inundated with requests to do some punditry. How are Tyrone fixed?
We're probably getting every other county disjointed. You know, we're trying to get back into the swing of things. We're trying to hit the ground running again. You know, one thing about, I think I actually did read about Tyrone over the period, was that they were training away behind closed doors and stuff, and which was madness, like, because, you know, we weren't, and, you know, things were, we were sticking to the guidelines. There were, you know, guys who were doing their own stuff. I was out of shade out the back doing the gym work, and, you know, that's the way things were. But, yeah, look, they're like every other county. They're starting at that bottom level, trying to get up to speed as quickly as possible, and just hope that there's going to be that everything's just going to go to plan. And, you know, it's going to be hard, because players have trained right through from last, even myself, you trained from last November, and then you come into the COVID period, you play a few games in the league, come into that COVID period, and it was nearly very hard to motivate yourself over that period to do anything, because you're wondering whether, you know, there was anything going to be happening. So for any counties that, you know, players have motivated themselves to go to a gym and do their runs and practice their skills, like, they'll start off definitely ahead of the rest, and that'll vary within each county, because, you know, say players are, some players probably took it well and other players didn't, so but Tyrone's like everybody else, they're just trying to get up and running and get back to basics.
Will they be up and running with Conor McKenna though?
I would imagine so. I don't believe he's surfaced yet now, but I would suspect that he might get he might get a call, and he wouldn't be a bad sweeper to step in for number 8 all right now.
Like for like is what you're saying.
That's it. No, right, exactly. Like for like. Same physical attributes and everything. Yeah.
Well, we are looking forward to the championship hopefully coming down the tracks. It'll be different not having you there. As I said, we really enjoyed watching you evolve as a player over the years, and we're well deserving of those All-Stars and that All-Ireland as well. Colm, enjoy the free time, although by the sounds of it, you will be sucked into coaching very, very soon, and you've a couple of kids to mind as well. We appreciate you taking the call, and we wish you all the best with the future.
Best no problem at all, Gay. Thank you very much.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry, or snack. Natural protein your way.
Game on 2FM.
Well, welcome back to Game On. The Listowel Harvest Festival got underway last Sunday, and at 5:30 p.m. this evening, live on TG Cahir, Best on Stage, one for trainer Paddy Toomey and jockey Billy Lee, as the curtain fell on day 3 of the 7-day fixture, just as the rain started to fall. But earlier today, I caught up with Rachel Blackmore, Paul Townend and David and Danny Mullins ahead of tomorrow's feature, the Guinness Kerry National.
Game On Racing.
Well, Rachel, you won it last year on Poker Party. This year, you ride Spyglass Hill. That's the bounce back, I suppose, from a disappointing run in the Galway Plate.
Yeah, we did great there last year, and it would be lovely to emulate that again. Really looking forward to Spyglass. Things didn't go right for us in the Plate. Didn't travel, and we made a mistake, so we had to pull the plug there early. But he seems really well at home since, so really looking forward to him, and hoping that the heavens will open and the rain will come.
Kerry National, the stall is a tight enough track. Like, do you think he has the pace to hold a position somewhere close enough that'll make him competitive?
Yeah, I think so. Henry's horses travel and jump, and that's what you need around there. So, and he's one of those. So, yeah, fingers crossed.
You've been having a great run, Rachel. You've had 8 winners in the last 3 weeks. Things are going really well for you.
Yeah, they are. Look, it's brilliant. We'll just try and keep it going now.
Paul, we spoke to Rachel Blackmore earlier, who rides Spyglass Hill, and he has to recover from a poor run in the Galway Plate, but you ride Cabaret Queen, who ran a blinder in Galway to finish third.
Yeah, she did. Good to see her show a bit of spark again, and hopefully the run in Galway will stand her going to the stall.
I know she likes to be close to the pace. Capitan is in there, who went a ferocious gallop in Killarney on her last start. Will that make things a bit difficult for you?
Yeah, well, I suppose all them handicap chases, you line up and you fly down over the first anyway, so she has a lot of experience in them. Hopefully we can get away and get into a rhythm in front. Big fences down there, touch wood, she's a solid jumper, and that might just put the ones behind us under a bit of pressure.
She was that way in Limerick last year when she won the Munster National. She jumped from fence to fence. Is that your plan? Get out there and use her jumping?
Yeah, I'd imagine so. We'll be as sharp as we can out the gate anyway, and you know the likes of Plan of Attack and Ravens Hill coming their first run since Cheltenham, so you know, they come from yards well capable of having ready, but hopefully the run will stand to us.
David Mullins, you ride Robin DeForre. He last won a race in the stall 2018 and you rode him. Are you looking forward to getting back on him?
Yeah, it's a big advantage having a horse that goes around the stall. Fences are big. He's a big horse and I'd say he'd really suit the track, and he's won there before. A lot to like about him.
He's won 9 races. He's been second on 9 occasions, but he is a bit of a weak finisher. What do you have in your mind to try and get him across the line in front again?
He was ridden a bit handy, I'd say, in the Galway Plate, and I'd be asking Willie, I'd say, if I could drop in a bit more with him and take my time a bit more. He seems to like to be ridden that way.
Danny Mullins, you ride Forza Milan for James Nash in tomorrow's Guinness Kerry National. James won it a few years ago, but you're busy. He had a good run in Cheltenham. He's a nice ride to get.
Definitely, you know, the fact that he's got a little bit of winter form on slower ground, the fact that we have rain forecast, that should be an advantage to him. James Nash has had his horses in good nick all summer, and I think he could be a lively outsider in a competitive race.
He has a couple of good runs which involve a lot of horses in this race. He was behind Carefully Selected when Spyglass Hill fell. He was behind Gordon's won the favourite Raven Hill in Cheltenham. Do you think with the lighter weight on his back he can get closer to those horses?
Definitely, you know, he got a little bit tired late on in Cheltenham in the National Hunt Chase, but that was 3.5 back to 3 miles here in a competitive handicap. You know, sometimes these unexposed novices, well, a second season novice now, but, you know, they can have their good chance in these big handicaps.
So, Ruby, there you are at work, riding out for Willie with your friends, Danny, David, Rachel and Paul, and then you all come in and you take out the microphone. How does that go down?
colleagues, Marie, colleagues. And I just tear out the microphone and say, I need a bit of, need something for the radio tonight, guys. Marie won't have any homework done, so you need to carry the show. So I need 4 or 5 minutes to get us over the line.
And they're simple, just too afraid of you to say no.
Probably, quite possibly, but in fairness to them, I didn't give them any option really. I just pulled it out and started talking to them.
It does sound like that. It does sound like you cornered them. All right. We've got a text in, Ruby. Who wins the Kerry National tomorrow?
I think Martel has a great chance, and I think the horse that was fourth in the Galway Plate of Edward O'Grady's, whose name is coming to me, the West's away, I think is a massive chance as well.
Right, well, we can't get away from the coronavirus, I'm afraid, because we're going to move on to football, and we're going to talk to Mark Langdon of the Racing Post, and we're going to start with the Carabao Cup tie between Leighton Orient and Tottenham Hotspur being called off because a number of the Leighton Orient players have tested positive for coronavirus. Mark.
Hello.
We're just saying we can't get away from the coronavirus, so no. The Spurs game is off.
It's off, and I think this is a very worrying position, really, for the EFL on the back of the statement today from Boris Johnson about no fans being allowed back into sporting venues for maybe as long as 6 months. That has come, maybe not over the last couple of days as a big surprise, but certainly when the season was starting, these in the lower two divisions particularly, they were expecting fans to come back. So there's a financial issue, and as you mentioned there about the coronavirus for the Leighton Orient players, the only reason that we found out about the only reason Leighton Orient found out about the coronavirus was because that Tottenham paid for the testing of the Leighton Orient players, because in the bottom two divisions you don't have to be tested. They haven't got the money to be able to test as regularly as what they do in the Premier League. So who knows what's going on in them sort of bottom two divisions in terms of who's to say that it's not happening at 10, 11 clubs? It's just absolutely rampant. I think it's a very scary situation, both from a health point of view, but just as worryingly, I think, for the club, sort of, if they're thinking long term, just how are they going to survive this season if there's no fans allowed in?
Mark, the BBC are reporting that Premier League clubs are considering ways of letting season ticket holders access matches not due to be broadcast live on television following this morning or today's government announcement. How exactly is that going to work?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be quite a complicated sort of process, presumably involving some kind of sort of streaming codes, but I don't see how that can work. It's very difficult because the TV companies don't want a saturated product. It feels like that they'd want every game to be on TV. It kind of makes sense in some ways, but they don't want it. This is kind of, they feel, sort of damaging their product to have so many games on. But you've got the other side of the coin, is that the fans obviously need some way of watching these games, because you're going to get into a very sticky situation if there's, say, a Premier League game that's just, say, involving Liverpool, that's supposed to be at 3 o'clock on a Saturday, and it's not available to watch on sort of British TV. How does that work? It doesn't effectively. So I think they're looking into ways because in the EFL, season ticket holders can watch and were able to watch games last season as well, via a streaming package.
Could be giving the Watch League of Ireland people a call.
Of course.
Mark, so Gareth Bale, we're already looking and talking about him extending his loan spell, even though he hasn't played yet and is not due to play for a while.
Yeah, I think Gareth Bale's enjoying it. He's enjoying the love and the warmth of being wanted again. Of course, I think the ideal situation is that he's a success at Tottenham and this loan deal carries on for the end of next season when he can get out of his Real Madrid contract. It's hard to believe on €650,000 a week that you can be kind of in a living hell, but it feels like it is in some respects. In a sporting sense, anyway, for Gareth Bale, the last two seasons particularly have been really difficult for him. And yes, I totally take on board that he should probably have integrated himself more, learnt the language. I think if you're paid that kind of money, then you kind of are obliged, I think, to do more and to be an ambassador for the club more than just on the pitch. I think you do have to be sort of more than just a right winger or a left winger. But the way he's been treated is pretty poor, really, from the fans, from the media. Zinedine Zidane not taking him to the game against Manchester City. They're kind of trying to rewrite history. I mean, he was a very important player for Real Madrid for a number of years. He's won four Champions League. He scored in two of those Champions League finals. In another one of those, he scored in a penalty shootout. He scored in Spanish Cup finals against Barcelona. They're kind of five words or whatever it was, goodbye, I think was also disrespectful. So I think Bale could have done more. I think Real Madrid could have done more. And it's sad that it's ended the way that it has.
Not only a very simple one for you, but for a foreign jockey to get a license to ride in Japan, he must be able to speak and write Japanese. Only two foreign riders have ever managed to do it. But Andrea Pirlo, Mark, has made a great start to his Juventus career with a 3-0 win over Sampdoria. But did you read his thesis, The Football I Would Like?
Pardon, Ruby, I missed that.
Have you read his thesis, The Football I Would Like, that he wrote for UEFA?
I haven't seen it.
It's online, it's fascinating.
Okay, well, I mean, I think what we saw in the first sort of round of matches was somebody that wants to press and sort of win the ball back high up. He plays two different formations. When they've got the ball, they play three at the back. When they've not got it, they drop into a 4-4-2, which is quite a modern way of, I suppose, approaching football, this kind of one formation in possession, another out of possession. But the thing that surprised me most about the start that Pirlo and Juventus made was how well Aaron Ramsey played. Ramsey was, I think, a flop last season, no other way really to describe it. First season in Italy wasn't a very good one. I think he was probably Juventus' best player. And it's really interesting that Pirlo gave him the opportunity and he took it. He took it really well. And I think that's all you can do if you're somebody like Ramsey, is to kind of, you know, impress in that opening game, play with a lot of energy, set up a goal. Maybe this is the start of something special for Ramsey at Juventus. And I'll definitely get on to reading Pirlo's sort of thoughts on the game, because it's a fascinating appointment, given he's never coached before at any level.
Maybe you could summarise it for us at some stage, Ruby, and send it on. Speaking of impressing, Ibrahimovic impressed Dublin last week, and he is impressing again for AC Milan over the weekend, scoring twice.
Yeah, I mean, I spoke about this last week, about just the way that he's sort of raised the standards of the AC Milan team. Another two goals. He moaned afterwards and said if he was 20 years younger, he would have had four. He was a bit disappointed with some of the chances that he missed, but still a very important player, even though, you know, he's really at veteran status. And I think he'll be a big player for Milan in terms of trying to get back into the Champions League come the end of the season.
Right, well, that is all we have time for, Mark. We appreciate you speaking to us.
Thank you.
Ruby, I'd say you like that mentality, do you? If I was 20 years younger, I would have scored two more.
I would never have admitted to it. I would have said I was as good when I was 40 as I was when I was 20. If I was him, he could have got away with it, couldn't he?
He probably could have. Right, that's all we have time for. Darragh Stewart is up next.